algae blooms are hitting homeowners and businesses really hard. Hello, welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Green algae is taking over Lake Okeechobee, and unfortunately, it's making its way to the east and west coast of the state, creating a big stink and harming ecosystems and economies. So what's the solution? Or is this just part of our reality from now on? Plus, a Coconut Grove man is in a battle against the country of France.
Why would they put to the street somebody who for 25 years has done pretty good for France?
What legal precedent does a country have in taking someone's website? And journalists are being challenged like never before. One group of journalists have come together to form a new web platform with a different spin on covering Florida politics. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Lake Okeechobee is filled with the green slime that is stinking up the area and making life miserable for people and animals dependent on it. It's the algae blooms, and that algae is spreading to both the east and west coast of Florida and hurting home values, tourism, and local businesses. Last week, Governor Rick Scott ordered a state of emergency. The Army Corps of Engineers has to release water from the lake from time to time because the Herbert Hoover Dike is old and in desperate need of repair. How do we deal with the algal problem in a political fight that's been going on for decades? We're joined now by ecologist Steve Davis with the Everglades Foundation. Steve, thanks so much for being here today, man.
Thanks for having me.
So how would you describe the current state of Lake Okeechobee and this entire algae bloom issue, which, by the way, is not new? We went through this a couple of years ago. It was really bad.
Well, the situation today in Lake Okeechobee is that we have about 80% of the lake covered in blue-green algae. We just got the latest satellite imagery that was interpreted from NOAA, and they've shown that we had a gap of several days with cloudy features in the imagery, so we couldn't get the information. But the July 14th image showed that the lake is covered with about 80% of algae, and that's been the case for the last couple of weeks.
And there's something unique about this time around than what we saw, for example, like in 2016. What is it? What's going on now?
Well, what we have is a blue-green algae species, Microcystis aeruginosa, that really thrives in high nutrient conditions. And by nutrients, I mean nitrogen and phosphorus. And in South Florida, phosphorus is really the most problematic. It's derived largely from fertilizers. And it has accumulated to the point in Lake Okeechobee that this particular species thrives. And it seems to be thriving in warmer temperatures. So as we get into the hottest summer months, the longest days of the year, it seems to be outcompeting all other species.
And you talk about that phosphorus, you're talking about fertilizers. So can we put a finger on who the culprit is?
No, it's really accumulation over several decades, contributions from north of Lake Okeechobee, as well as a few decades of contributions from south of Lake Okeechobee in the Everglades agricultural area. And it's led to a layer several inches thick of muck in the bottom of the lake that is very rich in phosphorus. And we're also today still seeing high levels of phosphorus and nitrogen coming into Lake Okeechobee from the contributing basins to the north, like Kissimmee River.
So all of that is basically, for decades, as you said, it's just been piling up, sitting there at the bottom of the lake. Eventually it gets stirred up. Is that what it is? It gets stirred up, it grows eventually, and then it starts, it turns the water this really disgusting green that we've seen so many photos of now.
Yes, and you mentioned stirring up, and we think that Hurricane Irma had a significant impact last year in September as the storm passed over the central part of the state and really whipped up the lake. It's a shallow lake. Many people don't realize that, you know, it's only 9-10 feet deep at its deepest. So that is with such a large surface area subject to mixing all the way down to the bottom with a storm like Hurricane Irma.
And so what happens is, as we've mentioned, the Army Corps of Engineers plays a big role in this because when that water level gets to a certain point, now there's a danger to the dike that is protecting all those communities around the lake. So they have to release water. And they release it east and west on the Caloosahatchee and the St. Lucie. And of course, that ends up in the estuaries, which ends up, we see on the coasts. The Army Corps of Engineers, I mean, how did they decide how many times they have to release? And really, I mean, is it just up to them, or can the state say, wait a minute, you're releasing this stuff and we're seeing this slime just head in both directions, and that's hurting a lot of people? But who's making that final decision? Is it the Army Corps of Engineers?
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers abides by an operating document. It's the Lake Okeechobee Regulation Schedule that was actually revised following Hurricane Katrina, when they were asked to go back and reevaluate dam safety standards. So the lake schedule that we're currently operating under was passed in 2008. That schedule takes into consideration the fact that we have a very fragile dike that is in need of repair, and efforts are being made to complete those repairs, especially for the more vulnerable areas. But you're right, as lake levels rise, they have no other choice but to release to the east and the west. That's the way the infrastructure was set up over a half century ago, when there was a need to provide flood protection for those communities that were developing to the south of the lake. So the system is working exactly the way it was designed. Everglades restoration, the comprehensive Everglades restoration plan, was actually devised as a way to work within the confines of providing flood protection and water supply for these communities, but also recognizing that there's a need for the environment. Reducing those discharges to the east and the west will have a great effect in allowing those areas to recover and improve, but also it provides that water to the Everglades all the way down to Everglades National Park and Florida Bay to the south.
I want to come back and remind people of what these algal blooms actually are and what the harm they cause. You know, besides just looking really disgusting, and I've been told, I haven't experienced it myself, the smell is intense, but what's the danger, the risk to the wildlife? And because, you know, think about Lake Okeechobee, so much of that is about fishing and the tourists there, but also to humans. What's the risk?
Well, I'll touch on the concerns with regard to the environment first, and we know quite a lot about. First, we know that when algal blooms occur, they occur in such abundance that they affect light penetration into the water that other organisms need. And when you get into estuaries, you think of seagrasses, the important habitat that they provide to coastal fisheries. When you have algal blooms in places like the Caloosahatchee Estuary near Fort Myers, that blocks out the light for seagrass. So seagrass dies. Habitat is affected. These algal blooms also not only produce oxygen, like a plant does during the day, but they're also consuming oxygen over the nighttime. And when you have very hot water and intense algal blooms, we run into situations of hypoxic conditions over the nighttime hours. And so you'll have some species of fish succumbing to the very low levels of oxygen in the water that they need in order to survive. But then we also add in this other layer that these organisms can produce toxins when they're growing in certain numbers and densities. And so it's the toxins that also become a compounding factor that also result in human health concerns.
So, I mean, I hear that and I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, this is Florida and you talk about these temperatures, the hot temperatures, and we're in that time of year. So we're just what, supposed to expect this is going to go through and last the rest of the summer? We're just going to have to deal with it?
I think that many people feel that we may continue to see these blooms through the summer. What it typically takes in order for these blooms to subside, one is a flushing event. So a large storm that might deliver a lot of water into Lake Okeechobee, where if possible, we try to minimize the discharges to the east and the west, send as much as we can to the south. But that water needs to be turned over because it's the biomass of algae that's accumulated in the lake that's causing the bloom. The other thing would be cooling temperatures as we move into the fall and winter that might.
So that's this summer. But then, you know, that means we're talking about every summer. And as with climate change, the temperatures just keep going up. So what? This is just going to get worse?
We don't know. We can expect to see blooms like this in the future, especially with warmer temperatures. We're learning that this particular species of blue-green algae thrives in high temperatures. So as water temperatures get up to 95 degrees, you might find that other algae reduce their uptake of nutrients and reduce their growth. This particular species seems to continue to thrive under those higher temperatures. So we need to resolve the nutrient problem, but we've also got to find another outlet for that water, and that's where Everglades restoration comes in.
All right, let's talk about that here. Again, we're discussing the impact of Florida's massive algae bloom spreading from Lake Okeechobee and causing problems throughout the state. Joining me in studio is Stephen Davis. He's the ecologist with the Everglades Foundation. Okay, so we talk about solutions. Part of it is not putting so much of this phosphorus into the system, but that's only one part of it. I read that if we tried to go in and scrape it out, it would take decades. So what is the other solution is to try to get the water to flow south as it did naturally. What are we doing about that right now?
Well, we actually have good news to report for those of you who aren't aware that we have a plan for a reservoir. This is really the centerpiece of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee in the agricultural area that will allow us to take water from the lake and send it south. So instead of discharging the water to the east and the west, you fill that reservoir to the south. Recognizing that that water is polluted with nutrients, as we've talked about, before water flows into the Everglades, there's a federal consent decree that water quality standards, particularly for phosphorus, need to be met before that water can flow south into the Everglades. So there's a network of treatment marsh area, roughly 60,000 acres right now, that are currently being used to treat water that runs off those lands into the Everglades. So we would have a storage and treatment system that would allow us to flow substantial quantities of water each year from Lake Okeechobee to the south. And to put it into perspective, we're talking about 370,000 acre feet per year on average. And that number may not make much sense to people, but it's roughly the area, if you think of a column of water, the area of a football field, 70 miles high, that is the volume of water that we're going to be able to send south each year.
Do we have an area, specific location where that reservoir would be located?
The area has been identified. It's state-owned land that's currently being leased to sugar farmers. That land will be used for the reservoir as well as an additional treatment component. So it's going to be roughly a 10,000-acre footprint for the reservoir and then an additional 6,500 acres for the additional treatment capacity needed to make sure that water's clean.
So where are we in the process of building that?
We have a report that was just passed through the executive branch and is now being considered by the Senate for their water resources development legislation. The House has passed their version. The Senate will now deliberate on theirs, and we hope that by the end of this year, we'll have a Water Resources Development Act that we can say this project is included in and will be advanced in the near future.
And that's depending on the U.S. government. But, you know, we've had this fight in Tallahassee for years and years about how to deal with this issue. I mean, just your opinion, your thoughts on how how legislators in Tallahassee have dealt with it. I mean, do you feel they've done enough?
Well, I can't speak to the entire legislature, but I can point to a champion that we had going back to 2016 when this occurred in Lake Okeechobee and we had the discharges that led to toxic algae in the St. Lucie. Then Senate President Joe Negron, whose constituency was most affected by the toxic algae in the Stewart area, he took this on as his mission as Senate President and really pushed to get through the legislature the enactments to get this reservoir planned by the state, which they did in very short order. And the timeline was expedited, but it's included as part of a post-authorization change to a project that was already authorized by Congress called the Central Everglades Plan. So this project is being advanced as part of that effort.
You know, there was also, because one of the things people were trying to figure out is to remove what's already there. I mean, we could wait for a reservoir. Obviously, the dike needs work as well. But you know about this, the George Barley Water Prize. So this is a prize up to $10 million. They're trying to find any group that can come in and figure out how can we remove a lot of this algae. And I believe they're down to a few finalists. They're expected to name the winners in August. Is that a possible solution? Do we need to, you know, head to the private sector or some other kind of competition where we find other people who come along and say, maybe we find a solution? I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it's going to be a combination of solutions and management strategies to solve our nutrient pollution problem. It's not just an Everglades problem. It's a global problem. I mean, you think about the Mississippi River and the Louisiana the dead zone offshore, all of that is attributable to a legacy of nutrient pollution. And management can only do so much because we have this problem of polluted water bodies like Lake Okeechobee, and you described how seemingly impossible it would be to clean that water body up. So our board tasked us with managing a prize, kind of like an X Prize. It's called the George Barley Water Prize. That would spur innovation of technologies that might be in their infancy and usher along the cream of the crop, really, that are very effective at removing phosphorus pollution and could be scalable to large water bodies.
Have you seen any of the ideas? Anything jumps out at you like that may be a really good one?
I have not been evaluating the technologies, especially those that recently competed as part of the recent stage in Toronto in a polluted water body up near in Canada. But I think that we know what technologies are out there. It's really combinations of different technologies and determining their effectiveness, and part of that is their cost. We currently use, as I mentioned earlier, 60,000 acres of land to clean out the pollution from the water flowing into the Everglades. That's obviously a very land-intensive and very costly technology. If we can lower the cost, even an incremental amount, you think of scaling up, that would result in significant savings, not just for South Florida, but globally.
Let me finish with this. I know that our neighbors to the west over in Naples and Fort Myers and that area, they are hit really hard because obviously being in the Gulf of Mexico, the algae has a chance to sit a lot longer and it covers a bigger area. And then on the East Coast, you tend to see it up in the, you know, the Stewart area, which is the North Palm Beach County area as well. But down here in Broward, you know, Miami-Dade counties, we're not seeing it as much. We're not seeing that slime, that we're not dealing with it. How does it impact us, and why should people down here care?
Well, I think people should care first and foremost because we have a pollution problem somewhere within the region. I think we're finding that we're all affected by it because once it gets into the national and international press, toxic algae in Florida being such a tourist-based economy, I think clearly we're being impacted by that. The Everglades is South Florida's water supply. The Biscayne Aquifer that many of us along the Lower East Coast depend upon for our water supply is recharged by the Everglades. We're currently dumping, as of today, about 4 billion gallons of water per day to the Coosa-Hatchee and the St. Lucie. That's water that could be flowing south to the Everglades, providing for the needs of habitats and coastal water bodies like Florida Bay, Biscayne Bay, that many people recreate in. But it also serves to recharging our water supply.
This is one of those stories that isn't going away anytime soon. It's been a battle for many years, and it seems to be getting worse. You know, what's the solution? Well, there are a lot of different ideas out there. Again, talking with Stephen Davis, ecologist with the Everglades Foundation, he gave us a couple of those ideas. But we definitely would love to hear from you if you happen to live or if you've seen any of this, these algae blooms. Share that with us. Find us on Twitter or on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Again, I don't know if I want to get out there, and I've heard what it smells like. Don't know if I want to experience that. Mr. Davis, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
We'll get you back in here. We'll find out if Congress does move forward, as you mentioned, with the idea for that reservoir. Still to come on the program, what happens when a country seizes your website? We have the story of a South Florida man who's in a battle with the country of France. It's all coming up next on the program here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, millions of people in France and their communities across the world are likely celebrating the country's World Cup victory. But for Jean-Noël Friedman of Coconut Grove, the victory may be bittersweet. See, Friedman used to own the website France.com, a niche travel platform for Americans looking to travel to France. Well, that was until the country of France took it from him. So how does a country take a website, and can you get it back? Well, Friedman is trying to sue the country now. WLRN reporter Peter Hayden dug through the complexities of this cyber legal case, and we talked to him about helping us understand how this all went down. So, Peter, take us back to 1994 when Jean-Noël Friedman purchased the domain name France.com. Do we know why did he buy it?
Well, he was pretty tech savvy. He's born in France originally, and he moved to the United States, and he saw it as an opportunity. You know, he knew, kind of had an idea that the internet was going to become a thing, a visionary. And so he bought this site so that he could set it up as a little business. He calls it, at first, a digital kiosk for Francophone speakers in the United States. So he would put information on there about French culture that could be found in the United States, and just sort of a hub for information about France and for French speakers in the United States.
But going to the intent of the website, because you called him a business savvy guy, you know, this is around that time when people were buying domain names and making a lot of money on them. Did he ever have the intention of perhaps selling it back, because it could have been worth millions?
Well, certainly, you know, toward the end, now we recognize, yeah, it's a very valuable asset, and I'm sure he would have entertained an offer. He certainly would have rather that than had his site seized. But when he originally bought the name, you know, he bought it to make a little business out of it, because it's a good, it was a good property. It's a good name, a good single name site name. And, you know, he didn't have any intention, I don't think, to cyber squat on it and just sit on it and wait for somebody else to make him an offer. He bought it to use it.
So over more than two decades, he operated this site. But what was his relationship with the French government? Did they make any attempts to take it from him over that course of time, or maybe work a deal with him?
Take it from him. They worked together. He actually worked in the late, say, 2000s, pretty much hand in hand with the French government, or at least closely with the French government tourist development office. In 2009, they appointed him to the board of advisors of Atout France, and they gave him awards. So he worked closely with the French government, and by all accounts, they had a good relationship until they didn't.
So let's go back to the moment in March when his website was seized and the French government took the website. What was Friedman's initial response?
Well, he didn't think it could happen. He was shocked, because since 2015, France had been trying through their own internal courts in France to kind of wrangle away the site from Jean-Noël, the domain name France.com. They, in 2015, for whatever reason, they just decided they wanted it. And then they began this court, this legal proceedings within France to confiscate or seize the domain name. And so he had an inkling. I mean, he was aware that this was going on. It was it started in sort of a lower court in France and then went to a kind of an intermediate court. So he was aware that this process was going on, but they had no legal authority to actually take this domain name from him. So he was comfortable in the fact that he had done all his due diligence when he registered the name in 1994, and it was his property. So when he logged on in March of this year, you know, he like spit out his coffee in the morning. He was just shocked and then horrified and saddened, and then started to figure out what he was going to do from there. I mean, this was his family business. He made money off this site by advertising and by kind of selling trips and these custom trips. And he says, you know, that's what his family was living on. So this was his income, and it's a big blow.
You spoke with Vivek Krishnamurthy, an attorney with Harvard University's Cyber Law Clinic that's representing Friedman.
We are the Republic of France. France is our name, and therefore, we just have a right to any domain name that has the word France in it.
So has the argument been successfully made before that a city or country has trademarked their name and thus it can't be used in a domain?
Well, it's been tried. It tried and failed. And the reason for that, Lewis, is that any domain name that ends in .com, and it's different for each of the endings, but for .com domain names, they are a kind of virtual real estate or virtual property that exists in the United States, because the national, like the registry, there's a registry of .com domain names. Like the official registry is kept on a computer outside of Dulles Airport in Virginia. And so that's where every .com site in the eyes of the law officially lives. In 2003, a man sued the city of Barcelona, Spain for confiscating his site, which was called Barcelona.com. And once again, followed this exact pattern. The city of Barcelona had claimed that the word Barcelona was their trademark, belongs to them. That's their trademark, so that they could take it. And they did. They convinced the registration company to give them the name, the web domain Barcelona.com. And then the guy took them to court in Virginia, where this master computer registry is located. And the guy won, and, you know, that argument didn't fly in U.S. court. You can't just say that everything that has Barcelona, every product or domain name that has Barcelona or France in it belongs to Barcelona or belongs to France. It doesn't fly. So in that case, the guy got his site back, and Jean-Noël Friedman and Vivek Krishnamurthy, the Cyber Law Clinic attorney from Harvard University, they expect the same result in this case.
I'm talking with WLRN reporter Peter Hayden about the controversy surrounding the website France.com. For more than two decades, a Coconut Grove man owned that website. He owned the domain name, and he was using it as a niche travel agency for France. But then the French government, back in March of this year, seized it, actually took the domain name, and now has it. The man from Coconut Grove is, of course, suing to get it back. Let's talk about that registry company that's here in the United States. Do you know if they were legally required in any way to hand over this domain to the French government? Do we know anything about why they gave it to the French government?
Well, we don't know exactly why they did it, because they won't talk to us about that. They wouldn't comment. They wouldn't agree to interview or even comment on the case to me, nor to some other outlets that have covered this story. But they were not legally required to hand over the site. That's why this case is so galling. And in fact, Jean-Noël originally registered France.com with the Jacksonville company Web.com for 24 years. He's been their loyal customer. So when France had this procedure going through its courts to try to get France.com away from Jean-Noël, Jean-Noël and Vivek Krishnamurthy, the lawyer, notified repeatedly Web.com, the registration company. And they said, when France comes and asks you for this website to hand it over and shows you their French court ruling, don't do it. Don't give it to them, because that court ruling does not comport with U.S. law. It's not, let's say, valid here. We don't know what went on between France and Web.com, but both the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Web.com will not speak about what went on or about this case.
Peter, did the French government at any point make any offer to purchase the domain name outright from Mr. Friedman?
No. And in fact, Louis, Mr. Friedman told me that they told him that outright they weren't going to make him an offer and that ultimately they would end up with the site. They said, you know, this is rightfully ours. We're not going to make you an offer and we're going to take it from you. And they did.
And you said that this was basically Mr. Friedman's livelihood. This is how he's supporting his family. Is he filing a suit not just for the ownership of the domain, but also for lost business transactions?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He's filing a lawsuit in Virginia, in the jurisdiction where that master list is for .com domain names. And he's asking for his site back. And he's asking for the revenue that has been lost in the time that the site has been taken away from him.
You talked with Friedman about how his relationship with the French government has changed as a result of this experience. Let's take a listen.
Why would they put to the street somebody who for 25 years has done pretty good for France? That the country I come from treats me like this is something that it's so shameful for me.
Considering how much of his professional and personal life was dedicated to this country, do you get the sense, Peter, from Mr. Friedman, that he'll ever be able to look at France the same way?
I think this experience has certainly strained the way he looks at the government of France. And I think he's really hurt about that, as you heard in his voice in the clip that you played, that he feels betrayed by France because he's spent a good part of his life promoting the country in the eyes of the world and promoting people to visit. I don't think it's colored his vision of actually the country of France or the people of France. And this is his home, you know, this is where he's from, and he loves this place.
That was WLRN reporter Peter Hayden. You can listen to the full story about the seizure of France.com and find more information at WLRN.org. Just wondering what that website must be worth today, considering they won the World Cup. Well, still to come, a group of journalists take a whole new path to covering Florida state politics. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, as we approach the primaries in Florida's gubernatorial race, and of course the heated political races this fall, a new media outlet has launched in Tallahassee. The Florida Phoenix, a progressive-leaning news platform comprised of veteran journalists, is taking a different approach to their reporting. They're producing in-depth features on everything from marijuana in the Sunshine State to the unreliability of polling data with a focus on long-form reporting and commentary that goes beyond covering the latest political scandal. Julie Hauserman is the editor-in-chief of the Florida Phoenix. She was formerly a voice on NPR and Capitol reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. And reporter Mitch Perry spent nearly two decades writing for FloridaPolitics.com, also working at WMNF Radio in Tampa. They're joining us now from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Julie, Mitch, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon.
So, Julie, I mean, your team is coming from established news outlets like the Tampa Bay Times, FloridaPolitics.com, done some NPR. Why leave those institutions and start a brand new media company?
Well, you know, right now we're sort of in the not knowing when it comes to information. People are trying various platforms to see what'll stick at this point. And I think, you know, it's exciting to be able to be part of an outlet that's forging a new way in Tallahassee.
And Mitch, I wanted your take on, you know, leaving, I guess, if we want to call it the established media, but just, you know, those established institutions that have been around a while and breaking out. Is this the best time to do it or is it still scary?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think it's actually nice for us to break out. We just did a week and a half ago here in the dead of summer where things aren't too super hyper going on in Tallahassee. It kind of allowed us some breathing room to break out. But as you mentioned, you know, the primaries, we're just 6 weeks away from it actually starting tomorrow. So I think we're getting some headway, some momentum here, and it's an exciting time.
Julie, what's the focus? I mean, I gave a very brief description of the Florida Phoenix, but what's the focus for you guys? What type of stories are you covering?
Well, one of the things that we're not going to do is, you know, there's some good reporting that's already going on in Tallahassee that does the daily, every day, every, you know, committee meeting, every news conference. That's, you know, done by the News Service of Florida and Politico to a certain extent and the Tampa Bay and Miami Herald bureaus. So what we're going to try to do is pull back a little bit and look at stories a little bit differently. I think you can see from our launch that we, you know, we did have sort of a different editorial focus than some of the traditional media. It's a little bit like an alt-weekly, more so than, you know, a daily. And of course, we're going to have daily news items every day on our blog. We'll have that keep running in our social media for sure. But we're going to try to pull back a little bit and look at stories a little bit differently.
And, you know, we live in this time. It's always, you know, I don't want to get into the weeds because I know it's easy for us that, you know, we've been in the business a while, but you consider the environment that we live in and the way that the media has been attacked. And so I'm always interested in trying to find a way to create the transparency. I want people to see what we do and how we do it. You know, when you think about the way that you lay out your stories and the kind of stories that you're pursuing, you know, we still live in this world where it's so much about click bait and getting attention and getting eyes and ears. So how do you do that when you're covering, you know, you're digging into stories and at a greater depth than, you know, your typical news outlet will daily? But how do you do that in this world today, still getting attention, but without falling into that trap where you're trying to get attention?
Well, I think we're going to find out. You know, like I said, we are in the not knowing of the information landscape. Certainly, we hope people click on the Florida Phoenix because that's the metric that everybody's using. But, you know, some of these newsrooms, they have big screens that show whose story had the most clicks on it. And it's a little demoralizing for the person who's done the investigation into something with the city council getting very few clicks and somebody who did, you know, a story about the local shelter or, you know, a cute kitty or something getting a lot of clicks. And I think that's just a problem that we're having. I think us not being a commercial enterprise is going to help with that.
Now, does that mean then basically you're not tracking to see what stories are getting clicked?
You don't? Oh, of course we're paying attention to every analytic.
We wouldn't go that far.
But I mean, yeah, because how do you do it without it being demoralizing? You have, you know, you have a reporter who's covering a beat and covering a story that you know, this is so important. It's so powerful. But yeah, people want to click on the kitty or puppy videos more.
Right. And back in my day, you know, when I was a news reporter for a very long time at newspapers, and we just threw that paper on the end of your driveway, and we didn't know what you read, and we didn't know which stories were interesting to you, unless, you know, we got a letter to the editor a week later or something like that. So this is a different time where you can track how long people read through the stories, when they jump off, what interests them, what doesn't. And we're just going to have to find that out. We're just starting out, and we're doing the stories that we think matter as they come to us, and we hope that it'll stick.
All right, so let's get to the nitty-gritty, though. It's like anything else, money. Money plays a big part. How is this being financed?
So we work for a foundation called the Hopewell Fund, and it's a group of investors or philanthropists that believe that because there's been so many cutbacks in state government reporting, that it's leaving the public not informed of things that they need to know about, because many national concerns are now running their initiatives through state legislatures because it's easier than trying to get anything done in Congress. So there's a lot of news and fewer people to cover it. So these philanthropists are going to several states. I think we have a new site in Nevada as well called the Nevada Current, and one launching today in Virginia to get qualified and veteran reporters who know state government and know how to make state government interesting and know how to tell people how their tax dollars are being spent and who's making the decisions. And that they believe that that is a public service and are willing to give us a foundation, some foundation funding for that.
And is any of this dependent on your audience? How much are they paying for?
We're free to people, and we're free of advertising.
Do you think that that's sustainable? I mean, have you seen other organizations do this that you could say this can we can go a while this way?
Yes. The North Carolina site called NC Policy Watch has been a concern for 14 years, a media outlet for 14 years. And they expanded, actually. They have podcasting. They have some video. And they cover the North Carolina legislature. It was begun by reporters who covered the State House in North Carolina.
And Mitch, how is this, well, better yet, how do you explain the level of editorial independence from that primary grant funder? I mean, how do you show people that, yes, we depend on them, obviously, for the dollars so that we can keep this going, but we're separate?
Well, I would say basically I haven't heard from him yet, so I think we're all good so far. I think through Julie or they directly contact us. Basically, they are letting us do what we I think they hired some professional folks here, starting with Julie, and letting us do what we need to do. We are early on. I think this is our second full week. Actually, we started the day after 4th of July, so. Again, we're still getting into the practice of doing this. I haven't heard anything back from the editorial folks in, I guess, North Carolina where they're based. So far, so good. But yeah, I mean, it's always, right, whomever pays, they want something out of it. I think, ideally they want really good stories that maybe break some news on occasion. We're definitely under some I don't want to say pressure, but we want to deliver for them, absolutely.
We're talking with reporter Mitch Perry of the Florida Phoenix, also with Julie Hausserman, editor-in-chief at the Florida Phoenix. This is a new progressive-leaning journalism outlet based in Tallahassee, covering politics in the state of Florida. They're joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Let's look at some of your recent pieces. Mitch, you had a very interesting story about the unreliability of a lot of our polling data. And, of course, as we're coming up into the election season, what did you find?
Yeah, well, you hear this a lot these days because we're so prevalent now using cell phones, right? And sometimes people want to know, well, are these pollsters reaching people on cell phones? And that's what we learned in the story is it depends, basically. And, of course, you can usually read that at the end of a poll. If you get through that, not read the news story itself, but link to the poll and find out if the pollster is using it, what the percentage of landline versus cell phones are. It's more expensive, definitely, to call via a cell phone. We learned that. And so I think that's really crucial for people to understand. And then there's some pollsters who don't do cell phones at all and are still actually reliable. I quote in the story of St. Pete Polls, which I worked a lot with when I was down in the Tampa Bay area. And they don't see, sometimes people question their polls because they don't do any people with cell phones. But basically by weighing the poll, different things like that, that these pollsters do to try to find the likely voters out there, which is, a big challenge for them to find people who vote the last couple of elections. But as we reported, that was tripped up a little bit during the 2016 campaign, although maybe it was a little overrated how the pollsters got it wrong when they predicted Hillary Clinton to defeat Donald Trump. But I think, again, we're seeing this today. In fact, we've got a couple of new polls out today that show new leaders in both of our gubernatorial races. So I think we all have to take that with a little bit of grain of salt and keep on watching them unfold as they will as we get closer to August 28th.
And you kept saying it. It all comes down to, are they reliable? I mean, what do you tell people as to how they should even take that information? And there's so many polls that are going to be thrown at us between now and the primaries and, of course, the November elections.
Gwen Graham said at the end of the story, it's a kind of the cliche, the only poll that matters on election day, right? I think everybody except for Chris King is in the Democratic race has now been leading at one point because we have a new poll out today that shows Jeff Green actually leading, which is somewhat stunning, but maybe not because he's been inundating the airwaves since he entered the race a month ago, right? Phil Levine from down your area there, former Miami Beach mayor, has led a lot of the way or closely over Gwen Graham. Just doing the same thing, throwing a lot of ads. It's kind of the Rick Scott formula. It seems to work in Florida in this huge state with 10 media markets. We'll see. I saw Gwen Graham's actually today putting some ads out down in South Florida finally. She's going to have to kind of ramp up here because I think it's really, at this point, it's about who has the most ads on, who gets the most love in these polls.
Is it about the latest poll, or are we talking about do you have to look at the long-term trends?
Right, you know, or the aggregate, right? I think that what the real queer of politics does, they often, they just look at the average of all the different polls that are out there. You can look at trends, though, right? I mean, I think definitely a trend in the Republican race is Ron DeSantis. Whether you believe he's actually leading this race or not, there have been now, well, there's a new Fox News poll out this morning. He had his own internal poll, and there's a poll that came out a week and a half ago from a group that really nobody had heard of, but they all show him up. And I think that, you know, I think Adam Putnam's taking that seriously. Let's just put it that way.
If I could just jump in. Yeah. Also, I think one of the things the Phoenix does offer is, you know, Mitch has been covering this stuff for a long time, and he can parse that stuff out for readers. And I think there's a value in that, in the fact that we're people who really know state government and really know politics.
You know, earlier in the show, we had on an ecologist. We were talking about the toxic algae blooms coming from Lake Okeechobee and how that's impacting everyone here in South Florida. And Julie, this is an issue you've covered for years as a reporter and as an environmental activist.
But I hate to show my age, but yeah, since 1986.
Well, that's you know what, we all have to at some point. It's okay. But I was thinking about this. I was thinking, are we covering this the right way? Are we, you know, what are we doing with any issue that I put on the show? We're always thinking, are we covering it right? Or are we missing something? But I mean, have the conversations around the solutions to that problem, to the algae blooms. Have they evolved over time? Or are we doing it right?
I don't think so. I think there's a couple problems with the coverage. One is everybody blames the sugar companies, but the sugar companies are located south of the lake. They used to back pump their pollution into the lake, but there was a citizen lawsuit that stopped that practice. So the stuff is coming from north of the lake and east and west. So it's big cattle operations. There's big dairies down there. There's a lot of industrial, what do I want to call it, slime, basically, that's coming down from the Orlando area, sewage, manure, fertilizer. The idea that we're somehow going to pump this now to someplace else and that's going to be fine is ridiculous to me. And nobody cared that much about the pollution in Lake Okeechobee. The only time anybody cared about it and started screaming about it was when it started showing up in front of very pricey homes on the East and West Coast. And so the politicians are desperate to stop that from happening anymore. But these things need to be mitigated at the source. They need way more strict regulations to handle manure, for one thing. You know, agriculture is exempt from so many of our nation's environmental laws, and it's wrong. And they control this pollution elsewhere in the world, and they can do it here.
How big of an issue do you think that this is going to play? And you think about that we're in the summer where that the algae blooms are really going to be at their worst. How big an issue is this going to play in the elections?
You know, every year they ask that same question, and, you know, I think it's just a wild card. It depends on people's, you know, their economic security and who holds the power. Certainly the constituency south of the lake that they're trying to protect with this giant dike is, you know, pretty impoverished area of migrant farm workers. So I don't think they'll have a lot, you know, of sway in the election. But, you know, it remains to be seen whether these folks who are living on these waterways will be angry enough. And the thing is, a lot of them don't live here. You know, they come down for the season, but they don't live here. So that's a whole nother thing.
I did want to ask you guys before we finish up that, you know, this web platform started shortly after the shooting in Maryland at the Capital Gazette newsroom. And I just wondered, you know, where both of you were at the time and really where that impetus was to get this started.
Yeah, well, I was at the museum, actually, in Washington when the shooting happened, so we were about 45 minutes away. I had no idea that Rob Hyacin, you know, brother of my friend Carl Hyacin, the writer, the Florida writer, was in the building. It was heavy. You know, it was really heavy to imagine that something like this could happen, and it definitely made us feel, sad when we started. When I started out, I felt sad and pretty rattled by it.
Mitch?
Yeah, Diane Rado, one of my colleagues and myself, we were together and when it came across Twitter, I guess that Thursday afternoon, and it was scary because we've had so many, as everybody knows, so many gun tragedies in this country for years, and there hasn't been really one in a newsroom that I can recall at all. And the fact that, you know, there's no place that's you know, vulnerable to these type of things. But it was just a terrible day, terrible day.
Julie, in the short time that I had, 30 seconds or less, if you could, I wanted to know, because I mentioned what's going to be unique about the Florida Phoenix is the way you're approaching stories, not just attacking the long form story, but it's also about looking at certain types of stories, being more progressive. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, people who believe in clean air and water, people who believe that education should be for everybody, people who believe in equality, people who believe in health care for everyone. These are the types of readers that we're interested in getting news to. There's so much noise from the bad acting politicians that good ideas are not lifted up and are not highlighted because the press just doesn't have time anymore. And we hope to do those stories. People who are doing solutions to problems and coming up with good ideas that we think are good.
Julie Hauserman, editor-in-chief at the Florida Phoenix, and we also heard from reporter Mitch Perry. Again, the Florida Phoenix, a new progressive-leaning journalism outlet based in Tallahassee covering politics in the state of Florida. Julie, Mitch, thanks so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
And again, they were joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.